companies often reflect the attitudes of people working in them. So if you allow people of faith to have a voice within the company, their views can be represented.
Keeping the faith at work. As controversial gender theory gains corporate support, we speak with Catholics holding the line for their beliefs in hopes of reversing the course.
And, you know, we've had issues presented to us by some of our principals who are responding to children and parents who suffer with this gender dysphoria. And principals sought guidance from us.
Countering radical gender ideology, the pastoral letter on how to walk with those suffering from gender dysphoria with love and compassion.
I think that we've been making tremendous accomplishments, and I think we have to continue with this trajectory and involve the voices of more women.
And women leading the conversation on abortion, an invitation from pro-life Catholics to controversial pro-abortion Catholics to open dialogue in hopes of helping mothers have access to life-affirming care. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
What's the relationship between Bud Light and a trans influencer? Well, none that's rational whatsoever, but if you want to signal, hey, we're being edgy.
There's so much confusion in our culture about sex and gender and the whole so-called trans movement.
Confusion on what it means to be a man or woman spreads as the transgender movement penetrates the corporate world and floods media outlets. But the rise in corporate activism that supports this ideology is facing a growing backlash. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. We're in the midst of watching a massive shift in cultural norms as so-called gender ideology sweeps the nation. It calls into question the very definition of what a woman or a man is. It aligns gender with a feeling or idea, rather than something directly tied to biology. The shift is being backed now by multi-billion dollar corporations in the U.S. and abroad. But it's not always working out to their financial advantage. Mark Irons explains.
Producing profit is the bottom line for many companies. But is there something even more important to promote?
Truth.
Businesses shouldn't market lies or distort God-given natural law about biological sex, says Michael Pakolik, a professor of ethics and social philosophy in the business school at the Catholic University of America. Still, don't be surprised when a multi-billion dollar beer company doesn't promote faith and family values.
The reasonable thought is, why should we ever think Budweiser would be in harmony with our deep beliefs?
Sales of Bud Light plunged to an unprecedented level after social media star Dylan Mulvaney, a man who presents as a woman, was part of an online advertising episode.
Possibly the best gift ever, a can with my face on it.
The transgender activism shown off by Bud Light, a product of Anheuser-Busch, brought outrage from some conservatives on social media and led to a boycott of the beer. But looking at its market capitalization, Professor Pakolik believes Bud Light's financial future will remain secure.
It's completely rebounded, so it hasn't been hurt in its share price.
Beyond the money, the bigger question and bottom line may be, how are the ideas pushed by major companies impacting the wider culture?
If we're trying to live by the truth as a society, well, then, you know, whether you're kind of thinking, you know, Dylan Mulvaney is a good endorser of your product or not bears upon that question.
And the decisions of a company can affect the workers within. A Catholic employee with Anheuser-Busch who wished to remain anonymous for fear of losing their job shared with EWTN News In Depth after the Dylan Mulvaney endorsement, they questioned, quote, can I continue to work for this company or not? They thought it was just the latest example of an LGBTQ agenda on display that conflicted with their own Catholic beliefs, after the previous sale of gay pride beer cans and a drag queen trivia hour hosted inside an Anheuser-Busch office. Still, this employee sees an opportunity and said, quote, Catholics need to stay at their post and try to change the institution from within. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of it. And so we have to be in these companies, but not ascribe to everything of the company.
A person's religious identity defines how they look at the world. So
Brian Grimm believes religious representation is good for business. He's president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and says while some companies are calling for the acceptance of sexual identities in the name of workplace inclusion, it's important not to exclude others, including people who identify with faith.
If you're going to include people's personal identities or their social identities or physical identities and the worldviews associated with them, then it's very important that you include also religious identities and the worldviews associated with those.
And when it comes to worldview, regardless of faith or practice of religion, traditional family values can play a big part. Next month, Disneyland will host Pride Night. A longtime worker with Disney, wanting to remain anonymous for fear of losing their job, shared with us they do not support the event, believing it further erodes a family culture Disney used to have. Telling us, quote, "It's my responsibility to try to keep that old culture alive when I can." Disney and Budweiser both call for inclusion in their workspace. But according to Brian Grimm, neither company has faith-based employee resource groups, at least there's no public record of them. Meanwhile, an organization like the Ford Motor Company has a unique offering, the Ford Interfaith Network.
Encouraging us to bring our full selves to work.
My Savior God to thee.
And this week, on the National Day of Prayer, Ford hosted a prayer event open to the public. It may not take social media by storm. Controversial beer cans have recently been getting most of the attention. But don't forget, in the middle of a big business marketing ploy, the loss of some money and social media outrage is a person.
What if Dylan Mulvaney were your son? I mean, you wouldn't want him to be turned into some kind of object of debate.
And what role can Catholics play when someone is confused about their identity? Dylan Mulvaney once said in an online video, "I grew up super Catholic, and I was turned away from the church when I was coming out as gay as a teen." Adding recently, "I still have my faith, which I am really trying to hold on to right now." Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
As Mark showed us, the corporate pursuit of policies that support gender ideology is facing resistance. And it's also facing some resistance in the political world and academic areas. In California, two teachers filed a federal lawsuit against leaders of the California State Board of Education and their school district for policies they say ask them to lie to their students' parents. The teachers say the policies force them to validate a child's gender, use the pronouns the child wants, and prohibits them from telling the student's parents about the child's requests without student permission. The lawsuit alleges the policies are unconstitutional, violating a teacher's religious liberty and freedom of speech. It's the second such lawsuit against these policies in California. In Oklahoma, Catholic bishops are praising new legislation that bans gender transition surgeries for minors. This week, Oklahoma's governor signed into law a bill that makes it a felony for a healthcare provider to administer hormones or perform gender reassignment surgery on anyone younger than 18. The child, parents, or legal guardians can also file a civil suit against a healthcare provider who provides transition surgery to a minor. Violating the law can result in the loss of medical licenses. Oklahoma is one of more than a dozen other states that are banning or setting limits on so-called gender-affirming care for people under the age of 18. According to the New York Times, this map shows the states where puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and transition surgeries are facing total or partial bans. Bans are temporarily blocked in Arkansas and Alabama due to court injunctions. Just a day before Oklahoma's bill was signed into law on Monday, Oklahoma City Archbishop Paul Coakley released a 14-page pastoral letter on the transgender movement. In it, he shepherds the faithful on how to respond to gender ideology. The Archbishop opens his letter with a reinforcement of the biblical definition of our humanity and creation, an explanation of how our fall can lead us to a distorted understanding of who we are in the eyes of God, and how we're called to love every one of our brothers and sisters, especially if they're in pain. His letter calls Catholics to compassionately engage with those experiencing gender dysphoria. He provides advice for parents on how to love and talk to children struggling with gender identity and directs us to continue to bear witness to the truth of our creation. I spoke with Archbishop Coakley about the nuances of his letter and his hopes for its impact on the church and especially for parents. Here's the Archbishop on the record. Archbishop Coakley, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this very important new pastoral letter that you released. How long has this letter been in the works? Was there a catalyst in your own community that created this desire for you to publish something on this topic?
Thank you for the question and your interest in the topic. I've been working on this, seeking advice and counsel on this for quite a number of months. I gave a talk last fall, right after Thanksgiving. And this was kind of the most immediate catalyst. I decided to develop that a little bit further and issue it as a pastoral letter for the people of the Archdiocese and anybody else who might wish to read and study it. So it took a while to pull it together, but I consulted broadly, and I think we tried to find a balance that would prove helpful in a pastoral sort of way, and that's where it came from.
You also noted that some U.S. leaders are promoting, quote, what has been dubbed gender-affirming therapy, which seeks to bring the body into alignment with one's felt gender, rather than working to align one's felt gender with biological reality. You go on to say that scientific research and our faith affirm this, and affirming that is not helpful. And you also say that parents must use the pronouns of their God-given biological sex. Why was all of this important? All of these little pieces that you brought together?
Because I think the details of how we respond to this are important. We can show love and compassion and concern as a parent, as a pastor, as a friend, without jettisoning our commitment to the truth. And I think simply offering parents, for example, the little thing about the different nicknames that they might choose to use, and if their child wishes to be called by a different name or by to use a different pronoun, I think we can show ways, we can show affection and tenderness and compassion without succumbing to the pressure and that parents often feel subjected to by a young person, a child whom they love very much, who is obviously suffering if they were to bringing forth such questions and concerns as this.
Let's go a little deeper then into your guidance for parents and families. They're on the first line, the front lines of defense and protection for children. Should these conversations necessarily take place? Could that be seen as encouraging this issue or prevailing on the innocence of a child?
Yeah. You know, I think my point here is not so much to initiate conversations about gender. My point is to initiate conversations that parents need to be in communication with their sons and daughters, to be engaging them regularly and making time for these not just this kind of conversation, but about the things that matter, things that are important. Any conversation, I think I say in here about gender, should be just a small subset of conversations that need to be taking place in the family all the time. So I think as opportunities might present themselves and as questions might be raised about what the sons and daughters might be hearing at school or what their friends are saying or talking about or what they're watching on what videos they're watching, don't shy away from the opportunity to engage their sons and daughters on these topics, because their children are engaging on these conversations and on these topics with others. Why not with parents who the first role to be teachers and guides in their faith development? So I think we have to have conversations. We have to be in relationship and communication. I would leave it to the discernment and timing of the parents to when is it appropriate to broach these topics. But I think not to be willing to go there, if you will, is maybe a disservice to the children.
Was this letter meant to encourage your brother bishops to publish similar pastoral notes for their flocks?
Well, I would hope that they might consider it. There's not much out there at this point, but as I said, I've already heard from several bishops in the last 24 hours who have thanked me for this, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of them will find their own way to disseminate what I've tried to articulate in their own dioceses and in their own local settings. But yeah, I think we need to be more upfront and clear as bishops and shepherds about this matter. And I think our priests in our parishes need the reassurance that this kind of guidance from a bishop can offer. Because they're the ones that are on the front lines in their parishes dealing with this in a much more regular way than I am dealing with it.
They're getting questions from principals and parents, so it's a great gift that you gave to them. These are difficult conversations, but what do you hope the faithful and those who identify as or advocate for LGBTQ policies, what do you hope they glean from your letter?
I guess I would hope that they recognize that that God has created us all in his image and likeness because he loves us, because he cares for us. He sent his son to suffer and die for us, to redeem us, to liberate us from the shackles and slavery of sin, and to call us to something more. Just last Sunday in the gospel, Jesus says, "I came that they may have life and have it more abundantly." That's what I hope people will hear, that this is an invitation to experience and to taste and to know the abundant life that the Lord desires for all of his sons and daughters whom he has created in his image and in his likeness. It's an invitation, and it's a proposal to open oneself to the love of the Father and to experience that unconditional love that God has for all of us, that Jesus showed us, suffering and dying for us. That's what I hope.
Well, it's a great hope to have as we close out the Easter season. So thank you so much, Archbishop Coakley, both for this letter and this discussion.
Thank you very much, Francie. God bless you.
Archbishop Coakley did provide multiple resources at the bottom of his letter for the faithful to learn more about gender dysphoria, find support, and find mental health experts. We've listed a few of those sites on your screen, including EdenInvitation.com, CourageRC.org, AdvocatesProtectingChildren.org, and CatholicTherapist.com. The Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register, both owned by EWTN, will also be providing coverage of this interview in print and on digital. There will be a link to the Archbishop's letter if you would like to read it in full. My discussion with the Archbishop was much longer, and you can watch my full interview with him on the EWTN YouTube page. Clips and excerpts will also be posted on our social media channels. Still to come on EWTN News In Depth, an existential threat. The man who helped create artificial intelligence is sounding the alarm about the dangers of the fast-growing technology. The concerns being raised that could impact governments, businesses, education, and personal data.
I think we can all agree that if a woman makes that choice to have a child, that we should be there to support her if she's alone, and especially if the baby's father has abandoned her.
An offer to unite. Catholic women offer dialogue to arrive at a life-affirming consensus with the drafters of a pro-abortion letter. Pope Francis completes a three-day visit to Hungary, to the cheers of thousands. At an open-air mass in Budapest, he pleaded for an end to Russia's war in Ukraine and encouraged Hungarians to welcome immigrants and the poor. The Holy Father called for a future full of cradles, not graves, and a world of brothers, not walls. Pope Francis had promised to return to Hungary after a brief seven-hour stopover there 2 years ago. The war in neighboring Ukraine and the plight of refugees from that country dominated the pontiff's message during his visit. His remarks were punctuated with strong opinions and a call for peace. Benjamin Crockett from our Vatican Bureau explains.
Hungary was thrilled to receive the Holy Father for the second time in 3 years. After the Eucharistic Congress in 2021, Pope Francis fulfilled his promise and came back for an apostolic visit. While there was much joy on the part of Hungarians for the Holy Father's visit, there was a palpable cloud hanging over the entire trip. That cloud was the war raging in nearby Ukraine. The Holy Father privately discussed the war in Ukraine with Prime Minister Viktor Orban and President Katalin Novak. The trip of the Pope to Hungary had raised many questions about the opportunity to discuss the war with leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church. Patriarch Kirill has openly supported Russia's invasion. During Francis's visit, he was able to meet privately with Archbishop Hilarion, the Metropolitan Archbishop of Budapest and Hungary. Hilarion previously served as the head of the Department of External Relations of the Patriarchate of Moscow. The Pope, while on the return flight, said such encounters are necessary in the peace process. Pope Francis also said he has been secretly brokering peace between Ukraine and Russia. Officials of those countries deny any negotiations are taking place. The Vatican also stated it is willing to help facilitate the return of Ukrainian children taken to Russia during the war. A common focus of Pope Francis is reaching out to the poor and marginalized. The Holy Father made sure to meet with refugees, the blind, and disabled children during his three-day journey. He did not mince words in his initial speech to Hungary's government when he spoke out strongly against abortion and gender ideology.
E questa la via nefasta delle colonizzazioni ideologiche che eliminano le differenze, come nel caso della cosiddetta cultura gender che eliminano le differenze o antepongono alla realtà della vita concetti riduttivi di libertà, ad esempio vantando come conquista un insensato diritto all'aborto, che è sempre una tragica sconfitta.
Continuing his message reflected in the apostolic trip's motto, Christ is our future, on the final day of his visit, Pope Francis addressed more than 50,000 people gathered in the capital's Kusuth Lajos Square, urging them that in an open and inclusive image of Christ, a more abundant and meaningful life is possible. Just before leaving the country, the Holy Father once again positioned himself as a bridge, a pontifex, as a true facilitator of peace, praying for protection for the beleaguered Ukrainian people and the Russian people during the Regina Celi. Benjamin Crockett, EWTN News in Depth.
With the Pope's blessing, a historic decision to allow women to have a larger voice in the future of the Catholic Church. As we first told you last week, the Vatican has announced laypeople will be permitted to vote in the upcoming Synod on Synodality this October, and half of them will be women. The Vatican also plans to include a significant number of young people. All of the lay participants will be personally approved by Pope Francis from a list of people submitted by leaders of this year's Continental Synod meetings. In another change, 5 religious women and 5 priests will be elected to represent their institutes of consecrated life. In the past, it's all been done by priests. The first of the 2-part synod gathering will take place in Rome this October. And Catholic women with differing views on abortion are going on the record with their concerns. The opposing groups each released a letter, both asking for more nuanced dialogue about a topic that's dividing America. Using the phrase reproductive justice, a euphemism for policies promoting abortion, a group of 35 Catholic theologians and scholars held a public event to release this letter inviting Catholics and people of faith into a conversation about abortion. The letter reads, "We're told to choose life, even as the policies needed to build a culture of life and dignity for women and families are rejected by the same politicians who criminalize our reproductive decisions. The lack of quality health care, the high cost of raising children, poverty wages for workers, sexual violence and rape, and the racial gap in maternal mortality rates all impact how women make decisions about our reproductive lives. In response, the Catholic Women's Forum of the Ethics and Public Policy Center released this letter on behalf of about 50 Catholic doctors, nurses, midwives, and healthcare workers. They said, "We would welcome a comprehensive agenda that would better genuinely support women and families, but we cannot, in good conscience, support that agenda if human rights violations like abortion are offered as a solution to unplanned or unwelcome pregnancies. Will you discuss abortion with us in a frank and honest conversation that includes science, faith, and reason? We would like to unite our efforts as Catholic women so that together we can arrive at a life-affirming consensus." To talk about these developments involving women in the church, we're joined by a distinguished panel. Dr. Pia DeSeleni is a moral theologian and expert on issues related to women's health, new feminism, and culture. And attorney Mary Fiorito, who's joining us once again, is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a director of its Catholic Women's Forum. Thank you both for joining us today. Pia, let's start with you. Talk to me about the Vatican announcement on women and the Synod on Synodality. For the first time, lay women and religious will have an opportunity to express their opinions with a vote about the future of the church. How significant is this?
Thanks for having me on, Monsi. It's largely a symbolic move, I think, on the part of the Holy Father, because the Synod is a consultative body. So the vote doesn't really carry any weight at the end of the day. The Holy Father will make his own decisions, will write his own document. So it's a symbolic gesture. At the same time, I really want to hesitate. I think we're so caught up in women having roles in the church that we miss the broader call of both men and women to be present as the body of Christ in the world. Mm. And I think that's really where our focus needs to be.
It always makes me think of someone like Mother Cabrini, who was so powerful outside of the Vatican walls. And I think that's significant and maybe the point that you're making. Mary, now the matter of these dueling letters from two different groups of Catholic women with differing views on abortion, one that's faithful to the church teachings and one that is not. This letter from Catholic healthcare professionals was addressed specifically to the women who signed the original letter from university professionals. Why was it addressed to them as a response and not to the broader Catholic community?
Well, what the medical professionals who signed the letter wanted to do was to respond to the request that the original letter put out, which was a call for a more inclusive dialogue about abortion and specifically about the Catholic Church's teaching on abortion. And they seemed to direct their letter mostly towards the bishops, but they mentioned male hierarchy, et cetera, et cetera, and compassionate clergy, as I suppose, contradicting church teaching as well. It wasn't a very clear letter in terms of the way it was formatted. And as I read through it the first time, I thought, my goodness, this sort of reads like a Planned Parenthood press release if Planned Parenthood were going to be writing for a religious audience. So it was a little sort of muddled in its format. And what the doctors and nurses and nurse midwives who put together this response really wanted to do was to engage about what abortion really is, because it's difficult to have a conversation about abortion law, abortion policy, how abortion affects women, without talking about what abortion is and what it does.
That's right. Now, Pia, you're a moral theologian, and Pope Francis last year asked theologians to consider the reality of the person in need in their responses. How does that instruction lead you to consider the issue of abortion?
I think this is completely on the heels of St. John Paul II, who talked about the lived experience. So we can't have moral debates that are abstract. We always have to think about who's involved. And so what I find, particularly in the abortion debate, if you listen to the women that are faced with these difficult decisions, if you look at the data from both sides, both people who support abortion and people who are against it, women who face abortions usually feel as if they have no choice but an abortion. And so if we're taking into account who she is and what she's experiencing, don't we really want to help her feel like she has the possibility to make some real choices, that she's not just forced into one, that her needs can be met, that actually somebody will be there to accompany her through this difficult time. There's so many resources that can be put into place and that can be mobilized. But if we're just going to the question of, well, abortion is the answer, then we're really not looking at the lived situation of that woman. Instead, we're saying, guess what? You're right. You feel that you have no choice but to have an abortion. That's the reality. That's all we're offering you.
And Pia, you just used a key phrase in the beginning of your answer. You said listening to women. And the issue of women in these discussions was brought up in this letter. It was suggested in the open letter on abortion and reproductive justice that these discussions on women and life have been had without women, and that the issue of courage was brought up, that was what might be necessary, but that they just weren't fostered in an environment to be able to be heard. What can you say about that?
You know, I feel so honored to be part of a huge group of women that I know exists throughout the world who have been having these conversations, participating in them, both with the hierarchy in the church and outside of the church with secular society. So I think that we've been making tremendous accomplishments, and I think we have to continue with this trajectory and involve the voices of more women. I think that we've been, in many cases, particularly on the pro-abortion side, we're hearing from women that have they're siloed, and they have an agenda. And yes, those of us who are against abortion, who are pro-life, yes, we have an agenda, but we are much more open to just the way that God's will plays out in someone's life, the way that somebody's life, it may not fit a checklist of what a perfect life looks like, and yet we're willing to work with that, and we're willing to help people and meet them where they are. But I think that women have been engaging, and I'm so honored to be part of that and to have seen this. And there were decades of women doing this long before I came along. So there's a long trajectory here that we're part of.
A trajectory of women who were courageous before it was cool to be courageous. Mary, this expansion of Medicaid that's suggested, you've come on our show and talked to our viewers about policy surrounding being pro-life. These staggering numbers on maternal health and mortality in the U.S. were also raised, noting that the Center for Disease Control and Prevention warns about the mortality rate for women of color in particular. What is the pro-life movement doing to address this?
Well, the authors of that original letter are quite right. The United States has an abysmal record on maternal mortality, and especially in communities of color. But abortion is not going to change that. We've had 50 years of abortion on demand in the United States, and that only increased the maternal mortality rate. It didn't decrease it. And one of the reasons why there is such a high rate among women of color is that they tend to have higher rates of hypertension than other women. They tend to seek medical care much later in their pregnancies. I have an OBGYN friend who is Black herself and who works primarily with women of color. And she told me once, you know, if women show up in their 6 month of pregnancy for their first prenatal appointment, if they have issues that could threaten their lives, there's not a lot I can do at that point going forward. I need to see that woman in the first trimester, you know, ideally within the first couple of weeks of finding out that she's pregnant. So, you know, the access to better prenatal care, access to community care is really critical. If you look at, you know, some of the worst neighborhoods in Chicago, there tend to be quite a few abortion clinics scattered throughout those neighborhoods, many of them within walking distance for most people. But, you know, we had a situation on Chicago's South Side when a Catholic hospital wanted to open up sort of a freestanding urgent care. And because it wasn't going to be providing abortions and giving out contraception, some of the others in the community from, you know, white people, wealthy people from other communities objected to the city giving the license to this particular Catholic hospital. Those kind of things have to stop. We cannot make abortion and contraception in these communities hinge on whether or not the women get the other health care that they need, whether they can get that hypertension care, whether they can get, you know, weight management counseling and nutrition advice and real care for the mother and the child together. And, you know, that's something, if the women who wrote this original letter are serious about that, about partnering for real good maternal comprehensive care for women. We're all in for that. We want to see healthy women having healthy pregnancies.
Absolutely. Pia, knowing that one in four American women has been affected by abortion, how do we have that conversation? And are pro-life women who do regret those abortions, or women who haven't had an abortion but understand this with compassion, are they welcome into this conversation?
They're absolutely welcome. And I think that we need to always, always be honing the way in which we have these conversations, making sure that we're approaching them not from a judgmental standpoint, but are we really ready to encounter them? The pro-life movement has done so much to help women with healing after abortion. This can only grow. And I think that particularly if our pastors are and our priests or clergy throughout the movement of various Christian denominations are equipped and ready to talk about this, because again, you know, the starting point is that most women who have abortions feel as if they have no choice but to have an abortion. That's the starting point. So we have to start there and help people begin to navigate either a decision that they're considering or a decision that's already been made and that they regret. I mean, I had a friend who joked that, you know, nobody really comes out about their abortion. Now, some of the activists do, but by and large, that's something that, you know, I've had medical doctor friends tell me, we can't even get this information from our patients unless we word the questions in a particular way. So this is something that women are not comfortable with. We've got to find more and more ways to meet women where they're at and to really to be that listening witness of the encounter that Pope Francis speaks about so eloquently.
It's such an important thing and so necessary. Mary, this letter invites all women into this conversation. Will the Ethics and Public Policy Center do something specific to reach out to the signers of the original letter to start a dialogue?
Well, we've already done that. We, again, as you noted, as we started our conversation, Monse, we addressed the letter directly to them. And we end it by saying, we hope to hear from you. And we do. We mean that genuinely. Again, the only way we're going to, you know, arrive at some consensus as an American public, not just among women, but as we see these, you know, these bills and laws being debated state by state, is if we arrive at a consensus among what the American people want, and we have to square it with the science. And that's what the doctors and other professionals were trying to point out in this letter. We have a number of neonatologists who signed it, who mentioned the fact that, you know, viability continues to decrease. Now we're looking at about 21, 22 weeks for fetal viability. I mean, the Sandra Day O'Connor, who was a justice of the Supreme Court, once wrote, you know, Roe versus Wade is on a collision course with itself, because, as you know, we do more amazing things with fetal surgeries that are performed at 16 weeks. There was a successful brain surgery, yes, on an unborn child that was just made public. You know, the letter from the original signers about reproductive justice doesn't mention anything about justice for that child, who's often pain capable. And if we are going to have a conversation as Catholic women who claim to follow the Lord, I mean, we know from the Didache, which is the very first manual of Christian discipline that was written by the first followers of Jesus, it explicitly condemned abortion by name. Right. In a Roman Empire where it was widely practiced. So we know that abortion was incompatible with the teachings of Christ, and it was absolutely unfathomable to Christ's first followers. So we need to take that gospel mandate seriously. And when we're talking about pregnancy and women, we're talking about two lives. There's a medical and ethical obligation to treat both the mother and the child. That's why obstetrical textbooks refer to the unborn child as the second patient. We want to love them both. We want to care for them both. And we know from studies done on women who have had abortions, the majority of them say, I had an abortion because there was no one to support me. It wasn't because of all these other reasons. It was because no one would accompany them and walk with them. I think that's an area where we can all agree that if a woman doesn't have someone to go to her appointments with her, to call her every other day just to check in on her and see how she's doing, I think we can all agree that if a woman makes that choice to have a child, that we should be there to support her if she's alone, and especially if the baby's father has abandoned her.
Absolutely. It looks like there are many points of departure for this great discussion. Well, thank you both. Thank you both for this. And I hope that they take you up on that offer, Mary. And Pia, we'll be looking for your analysis and guidance as we approach the Synod as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This week's top headlines are coming up, including a bill on limiting abortion that passed through one state legislature with lightning speed. but it may face a hurdle. That story and more after the break.
Ready for the pomp and circumstance. Great Britain is officially crowning their new sovereign. While the king is Anglican, his coronation ceremony is very Catholic. We'll explain ahead on EWTN News In Depth.
News about a brief exchange between a Russian Orthodox Metropolitan and the Pope tops the Week in Review. It happened just after the Holy Father's weekly audience on Wednesday. The Pope greeted Metropolitan Anthony, shaking his hand and kissing his pectoral cross before the two exchanged small gifts. They spoke for just under 1 minute. Metropolitan Anthony is the chairman for the External Church Relations of the Russian Orthodox Church. Pope Francis has wanted to meet with the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, since the start of the war in Ukraine. The two only held a video chat once. On Francis's return trip from Hungary, he noted that his relationship with Anthony has allowed him to be in contact with Kirill. Despite papal pleas for peace, widespread Russian shelling rained down on Ukraine on Wednesday. Strikes in Kherson killed at least 20 people and injured dozens more. Artillery strikes hit one of the few working superstores in the city. The attack comes as the U.S. announced a new $300 million security assistance package for Ukraine. State lawmakers in North Carolina advanced a bill that would ban most abortions after 12 weeks. The current limit is 20 weeks. A Republican majority in both the House and Senate helped the bill progress. Abortion supporters rallied outside the Capitol in Charlotte while lawmakers voted on the bill. The new ban moved with lightning speed, achieving approval from both chambers within 2 days. The bill now heads to Governor Roy Cooper, who called the bill unacceptable. He promised to veto the bill once it reaches his desk, though the legislature will likely override his veto. It's down to the wire on the debt ceiling dilemma. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told Congress this week the United States will default on its debt obligations as early as June 1st if the debt ceiling is not raised. It would be the first time in history the U.S. has not been able to pay its bills. President Biden has invited the four top leaders on Capitol Hill from both sides of the aisle to meet with him about it next week.
The president and the speaker need to reach an agreement to get us past this impasse. That's my message going down to the White House meeting. It'll be my message in the White House meeting. And I think that's clearly the way we get to a solution.
Democrats and Republicans each accuse the other side of gamesmanship. The Republicans want budget concessions in exchange for a rise in the debt ceiling. Democrats say the debt ceiling is not about the next budget, but about paying for bills that were already approved in prior budgets. They're suggesting separate spending cut negotiations. But economists agree. If America defaults, the worldwide repercussions could be catastrophic, causing a stock market crash, recession, and a big spike in unemployment. The rise of artificial intelligence, or AI, is giving rise to concerns of hacking, misinformation, and infringement of intellectual property. On Thursday, President Biden attended a White House meeting with the CEOs of top AI companies to discuss the risks and safeguards of the tech. And on Monday, the so-called father of AI, Geoffrey Hinton, quit his role at Google so he could speak freely about the dangers of the technology he helped create. The warnings are focused on tech called ChatGPT. This is a chatbot. Chatbots are typically used for automated answers to frequently asked questions on a website. But ChatGPT is much more advanced. It's capable of actually writing essays and computer code, creating images, having conversations with humans, and more. After launching last November, ChatGPT already has more than 100 million users. Hinton warns the technology could spread misinformation to the point where people don't know what is true anymore. The implications of the technology prompted the World Economic Forum to study its potential impact. A report released on Sunday indicates while some new jobs may crop up due to the new tech, ultimately, some 14 million jobs will disappear in the next 5 years as more companies adopt the artificial intelligence. and colleges now also have to tackle ChatGPT. For students, it represents a temptation to have papers written for them. For teachers, it poses the potential nightmare that students aren't doing their own work. Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas, is still developing policies and guidelines to address it. The head of the college's writing lab says reinforcing the importance of personal expression is important at this time.
I think that, to me, is kind of where ChatGPT is headed, is, you know, an opportunity for us to really think intentionally about why we have students write and have students really understand that so that they're able to kind of see writing as meaningful for them and important for them.
Some universities and school districts throughout the U.S. have banned ChatGPT on school Wi-Fi networks. And hackers are jumping on the bandwagon. On Wednesday, Facebook owner Meta revealed in a security report that hackers are using interest in ChatGPT to break into people's devices. Meta's security team said it found hacker software that claimed to offer ChatGPT tools, but it actually contained malware designed to give hackers access to people's phones and computers. Since March alone, the company blocked more than 1,000 malicious web addresses claiming to link to ChatGPT tools. Those scams helped hackers steal data from up to 9,000 users.
It is rich in Catholic symbolism.
The crowning of a king, a look at the Catholic roots and symbols used in the coronation of King Charles III. That's next. Stay with us.
Practice makes perfect for the big day. Bands rehearse this week ahead of the coronation of King Charles III. This band, from the Royal Air Force, plays a crucial role in the ceremony. It forms part of the procession that accompanies Their Majesties, the King and Queen, from Westminster Abbey back to Buckingham Palace. It's been nearly 70 years since the United Kingdom held a coronation. Queen Elizabeth II was crowned on June 2, 1953. London has beefed up security and is decked out in flags, ribbons, art, and more. The city is flooded with tourists and guests, eager to see the crowning. The Vatican will send Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin to represent Pope Francis. In April, the Vatican sent two pieces of the true cross on which Jesus was crucified as a gift to King Charles III for his coronation. The precious relics were inlaid into the Cross of Wales. King Charles chose to place the gift at the forefront of his procession. The gift is seen as an incredible ecumenical sign of goodwill and testifies to a lesser-known, deeply Christian aspect of the British royal tradition. We wanted to take a look at the Catholic origins of coronations. For that, I spoke with historian and author of more than 20 books and the woman who initiated Catholic history walks around London, Joanna Bogle. Joanna, thank you so much for joining us. First, tell us about the significance of the Holy Father's gift.
The Holy Father has given two tiny fragments of the true cross, the very cross on which our Savior died. And this will be carried in procession. They've been put into a beautiful silver cross. It couldn't be more significant. It couldn't be more significant. Given the troubled history of Britain, everyone knows the Reformation story and so on, this is a very moving and beautiful gift. And it comes at the first coronation of the 21st century, in, you know, having passed the millennium. And it reminds us of the unbroken record of Christianity in our country. Troubled, muddled, confused, but going all the way back, all the way back.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Now, I want to dig into that. It's definitely going to be a Protestant service, but how does this Catholic symbolism that we know is so rich of the coronation speak to the potential Christian unity despite the Reformation?
Well, I wouldn't really say that it's a Protestant service. We don't tend to use the word Protestant much in Britain as much as we used to. In all honesty, it's an entirely Catholic service in terms of the wording and the structure and everything. Any Catholic will recognize it as being framed around the Eucharist. But of course, yes, the Anglican Church is not Catholic. The orders of the Archbishop of Canterbury are not valid and so on. of course. But I wouldn't say it's Protestant in the sense of protesting against Catholicism. It is rich in Catholic symbolism. Catholics, for the last several coronations, have understood that. And this time, because we are in a warmer ecumenical atmosphere, we've had two wonderful papal visits to our country and so on, the Catholic side of things will come out very strongly. So really, there is a very strong Catholic symbolism. And the whole idea of the anointing, very familiar to Catholics, the Eucharist, of course, very rich. Oh, it's going to be very important.
Right. What can you tell us about that anointing and the oils that are used?
Well, these oils, and this is very interesting, were blessed in the Holy Land by an Orthodox cleric. So there is, again, something rich going on here. That's a very Catholic idea. If you look at the coronations in the 18th century, they were, you know, definitely Protestant, although they followed the old Catholic ritual. But the anointing with oil and having it blessed, that wasn't really the sort of thing they liked to do. It's very significant that Prince Charles, whose father, of course, Prince Philip, was an Orthodox Christian, Prince Philip of Greece, you know, he's always been interested in the Orthodox Church and, indeed, in Christian unity. So there's a richness there that was missing from earlier coronations of recent centuries, yes.
Something to watch for sure. In March, pledges were made by various denominations, led by the example of Cardinal Vincent Nichols of Westminster. What did this entail, this kind of Christian unity?
Well, the king, a new king by at that point, gave an audience, as one says, you know, they all gathered together, representatives of different faiths in Britain. And Cardinal Vincent gave an absolutely beautiful address. Each one spoke, and he gave an absolutely beautiful address. I've got a copy of it here, because it's just been published in the new May edition of the Westminster Cathedral magazine, which is a lovely glossy magazine produced each month, for which I happen to write, actually. But he ends up, "God bless your majesty and your queen consort." I'm looking down and reading it. "Preserve you both in health of mind and body and grant you every grace and blessing now and for the years to come." And he assured His Majesty of the prayers of the Catholic community. So very, very important. Catholics in Britain are loyal to the crown. It's very important to us.
Yes, and the number of Catholics and Anglicans is relatively similar, hovering at about 13 and 14%. Does rising secularism contribute to this public alliance that we saw under Queen Elizabeth? And do you think that'll continue under King Charles? You kind of alluded to that just now.
Well, there will be friendship. The days of real antagonism have gone. But there are difficulties now because the poor Anglican Church, I mean, they ordained women, and that looks rather wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong to us, especially ladies in mitres. They don't mean to be insulting, but to a Catholic, it's so wrong and contrary to what our Lord instituted. And they've just had a vote at their General Synod saying it is possible to bless the same-sex union. And this is a great pity because, I mean, a lot of my Anglican friends are in agony about all of this because they're rather traditional Christians. And we've stood together on so many issues. So I do see a problem there. Rising secularism is a big problem. And the churches of all denominations are in many ways reeling from shock after shock of a lot of things we all, I didn't particularly personally, but people felt would never change, and they are changing, particularly marriage and family. But I think there will continue to be goodwill. It's up to Catholics, really, to drive this with large minds and to stop trying to sort of, you know, score points against Anglicans. And any old talk of, oh, they took our old churches, we live with what we've got. And what we've got, in spite of difficulties, is a certain amount of goodwill. And I think that the king, whose own life and the way he grew up was in an age of increasing ecumenism. And I think that will very much be his motive. And he's a regular churchgoer. By all accounts, it means a great deal to him. So I think we can, at least at this time of the coronation, have hopes of goodwill. And Catholics must stand firm for the beautiful truths of the moral life in particular, which are written into every human heart. And I think a lot of Anglicans will rally to that.
And it's what we have in common, absolutely. Joanna, yeah. Two quick questions, just to make sure we don't run out of time. The first one is about something that I didn't get to ask you about, which is the crown. Tell us a little bit about the crown.
Well, there are various crowns. He will be crowned with a great, ancient, heavy crown, and then, because it's very difficult to wear it all the way home, he will wear another crown, one that is used for the state opening of Parliament. Crowning is a very ancient Christian tradition, and the idea is that a part of the thinking is you have to understand, the king has to understand that our Saviour wore only a crown of thorns. Mm-hmm. So there is this sense of carrying a burden and responsibility there. Very important.
That's a very significant burden. What can you tell us about how Camilla will be included in the coronation? I know that she's a figure of great controversy for many. The union that is being blessed now feels controversial to some and has been criticized. Give us some context as Catholics of how we can celebrate this coronation and this union.
Well, we're not really being asked to celebrate the union. These are two old people who have been together now for a great many years, and we must assume that at this stage, anyway, they are companions, and that's not going to change, and that's for life. She is less controversial than she used to be, and without going into any of the details, much of which we don't really know, I think the general feeling in Britain is let's make a go of this, because the public breakdown of the king's marriage and everything was so terrible for everybody's morale, and it certainly robbed the crown of a great deal possible dignity. I think the British approach is let's make a go of this. But of course, we know that it is not God's plan. God's plan is for one man, one woman in marriage for life. And Camilla is divorced from her, incidentally, Catholic husband who went on to marry someone else. So, yes, that's the situation.
I guess they'll let our Lord sort it out.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for this illuminating discussion. I know that we will watch eagerly both the recaps and also just all of the symbolism that you've described. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you, the King.
Up next on EWTN News In Depth, devotions to our Queen of Heaven. We take a moment to say Hail Mary in our own little way. Stay with us. For centuries, Catholics around the globe have dedicated the month of May to Our Lady. The tradition includes honoring Mary through rosaries, processions, altars, and crownings. We have our own tribute to the Blessed Mother in our Images of the Week. We're so grateful for reflections of beauty in the church that help us draw closer to Mary and ponder the mysteries of her role in our salvation. That does it for our program this week. Join us next week for more stories important to your Catholic faith. See you then.